The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, why should you follow Jesus when there has been so much hypocrisy committed in his name? Or at least the broader name of Christianity, from the Crusades to the Inquisition to Nazis murdering Jews during the Holocaust, and then afterward going to churches, both Catholic and Protestant, to less severe but no less hypocritical things. The husband who acts pious around his friends at church but yells at his wife and kids all the way home. The televangelist who seems to be in the ministry only for money and is always asking you to send in your dollars. Well, my friend, I sympathize with your plight. I really do. I myself came out of a Jewish background. My own people have been murdered in the name of Jesus for a while. That hung me up good. No pun intended. Only Jesus is being hung up was what counted. But in time, I did find this very Jesus. There is no hypocrisy in him. Yes, of course, people will let you down. God will not. And we will discuss this provocative subject later on in today's program. But first, we want to get into some of the latest news. And speaking of news, speaking of politics, I have an email here. It was sent from Kat, K-A-T. I assume that's short for Catherine or Kate or Katie. And here's what she writes. She's a younger woman. She describes herself as being 23 years old. She heard this show while she was driving. She says, I know that I am a nobody, and you probably won't care to hear this, but I have heard your show two times while coming home from school and listened in on your opinions. You say you make the obvious obvious. Well, here is something obvious. Why is it that you obviously lack balanced argument every time you speak? Even on your website, you sounded like a rational guy. So I checked out your website, and your articles are just like your radio discussions, nitpicking liberals, Democrats, and MSNBC. That's okay. People have flaws, but why don't you take that same scrutiny to Fox, conservatives, and Republicans? There is much hypocrisy, childishness, and red herring fallacy in their party. Or you could just tell the audience that you are biased and not neutral, as is implied, so as not to confuse them. Are you trying to be neutral, or are you just a defender of the Republicans? Not that this is a war, that there are many earnest Republican people as well as Democratic, but you seem keen on rooting out stupidity, childishness, and derisive talk and actions, correct? It seems to me your whole presentation would seem much more credible if you would be tough on both sides. I'm not blind. People are only human and prone to allowing their emotions to show, even if their position requires a lot of professionalism and objectivity. This applies to both sides. And I read your article called IRS, AP, Fox, Benghazi, Republicans, and Democrats. Yes, I actually did title my article that way. When you write for Washington Times Communities, they encourage those kinds of titles because it shows up in Google search engines. And hey, it worked. That article was in the Washington Times top 10 on and off all week. But anyway, that's my comment. Let me get back to what Kat is saying. So she says, I read over your article, IRS, AP, Fox, Benghazi, Republicans, and Democrats. You paint Democrats out to be so irrational and self-involved. And you both know that it is very stereotypical. you crusading against them in this way turns people against Democrats, so that what they have to say is scoffed at and not taken seriously. In this way, you keep Democrats and Republicans divided. Why not focus on what good things each party is doing, and then scrutinize and reprimand both party for flaws? I know you're not so haughty as to think conservatives have no faults. I hate all of the fighting between the parties, the pot shots, and the name-calling. The fighting causes us to never get anything done. I thought you were like me, but I was disappointed by your website and your radio discussions. Not that I'm all-knowing. I'm still a young and dumb 23-year-old. I guess I just wanted to be heard. Anyway, my two cents. Sorry for any spelling or grammatical errors. I really suck at proofreading, LOL. Okay, I really enjoyed this letter. I know she took me to task. I enjoyed it anyway. So let me respond. First of all, Kat, thank you for your comment, and no apology necessary about typos. I am the king of typos. By the way, when I was 23, I took zero interest in the news. Your interest is very much to your credit. I mean that sincerely. Now, as for your concerns, actually, Kat, I am critical of both sides, although I do believe there are far more problems with Democrats these days. I do. But I have criticized Republicans often and was very critical of George Bush when he was president, or at least he got a very mixed review from me. I have also been extremely critical of Ron Paul, Newt Gingrich, and Mitt Romney. You could read back articles on my Washington Times community column to see what I'm talking about. Although, yes, I would have preferred any of them to Obama. Incidentally, you should know, when I criticize Democrats, I am also being objective. I am, in fact, a registered Democrat and have been for my entire adult life. Now, I don't vote Democrat anymore because I'm a conservative Democrat, and they are becoming a vanishing breed in Washington, even though many in the Democratic voting bloc would identify themselves as I do, as conservative Democrats. Having said that, I have never claimed to be neutral. I have never claimed to be balanced. I have always admitted that I'm sharing my opinions. Now, I mean, I might present facts which support an opinion, but I've never claimed to be neutral. And as far as Washington Times goes, Kat, you need to understand, I'm not a reporter for the Washington Times. I'm in a whole different section. I'm a columnist. It's a big difference between hard news and editorial department. I'm a columnist for their online magazine section called Communities. That is editorial. In an editorial, one is always sharing an opinion or perhaps a fact that supports what some would claim to be a mere opinion, and then the fact shows them that it's more than an opinion. But either way, the guy has always taken a position. He's taking a side. As for balance, you know, it's funny because I've written a lot of articles, I've done a lot of radio shows about balance too, and I have challenged notions of balance or neutrality. Terms such as middle, centrist, moderate, balanced, neutral. I know those terms always sound good. I understand that sounds good. Sounds good, all right. But Kat, just because something sounds good, that doesn't necessarily mean that it is good. After all, are there not some issues of which we cannot compromise? Let's go back over 100 years in our history. Should the North have compromised with the South over slavery? With current issues, the stakes are just as important. Whatever side you come down on, either an abortion is the taking of a human life, or it's not. Either our current government is involved in some criminal scandals, or they aren't. Speaking of issues, Kat, I noticed you did not point out where you actually disagreed with any of my actual points. And with that in mind, I did make a few observations about your comment. First, you say that I sounded like a rational guy, and that's why you checked out my website. I would be curious to hear from you what sounded rational, and then what made me sound less rational after you continued listening and reading. All you offer is that my criticisms seem too one-sided. My suggestion is that you decide where you stand on one issue at a time. After we have moral clarity of the issue, we can then see which news network or which political party agrees with us. Now, about Fox News, they are the only major television news network showing both sides. Since both sides are important to you, I don't know if you realize this about Fox News. Sometimes people hear things about Fox News. I don't know how often you've watched it. Sure, they have Sean Hannity. And if he's not a conservative, nobody's a conservative. But they also have the following liberals: Bob Beckel, Juan Williams, Mara Liasson, Greta Van Susteren is liberal, so is Alan Combs, Geraldo Rivera, Kirsten Powers, Shepard Smith, Ellis Hannigan, Chris Wallace, which does their only main broadcast show on Sunday that's not on cable, but on broadcast, he's a liberal. Fox News Sunday. Now, Bill O'Reilly is their highest rated show. He's neither conservative nor liberal. Bill O'Reilly's an independent. He's conservative on most financial issues. He's much more liberal when it comes to things like the death penalty. Greg Gutfeld is another popular host on Fox. He's neither conservative, liberal, nor independent. He's a libertarian. He supports gay marriage. I disagree with him on that, but he supports gay marriage, and he's on Fox News. Having said that, does Fox tilt a little bit to the right? Yes, of course they do. With all their balance, you would still see them tilt more to the right. In their hard news, they're very objective. In their editorial section, and we distinguish that, with all the liberals and conservatives on both sides, I would still say it tilts a little bit to the right. But here's the thing, Kat. As Fox tilts a little bit to the right, the other networks tilt about 180 degrees to the left. Now, if you still think Fox is too conservative, okay, you're entitled to your opinion. But if they are the only conservative network, that would make it all the more important to watch them, wouldn't it? Because you sound like one who wants to hear both sides. And although you really can get two sides from Fox, okay, go ahead and continue with your viewpoint that it has just one side and proceed with that. I assure you, if Fox is giving just the side of the right, you can still find the side of the left from NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, NPR, MSNBC, and some 90% of the humanities faculty at most public and Ivy League colleges. Now, Kat, you also talked about name-calling. Let me say something about that. I think often name-calling is in the eye of the beholder. You said that so passionately, I assume you don't view yourself as a person who calls people names. And yet, in the very email that I just read, when you were talking about Fox News and the Republicans, you called it childishness, hypocrisy, red herring fallacy. Now, I don't mind that you said that. I think you were just expressing your opinion. But do you understand, somebody else could listen and say you were calling names. Sometimes it sounds more like name-calling when it's from a side we don't agree with. Well, what's my own standard? As a general rule, I don't believe in name-calling. Here on the radio show, how do I pare that down? When I have a guest on, even when it's somebody that I'm debating, or a caller, or somebody who disagrees with me, or somebody writing a letter, as you do, I treat them with respect. I'm also a political satirist. In Washington Times, they list me as a political satirist. A satirist wants to be funny, and I will take politicians to task, and sometimes sarcasm and satire just it makes a point in a different way. See, I don't think it's one size fits all in life. In one-on-one conversations, in debates, in dialogues, I treat people with respect, but particularly with high-profile politicians, I will call them to the carpet. And if they're doing something evil, I'm going to call it evil. And we could say that's calling a name, but is the name actually true? Anyway, write me again or give me a call. Let's talk about the issues one at a time. If you would like to explain to me with facts where you believe I'm going wrong, I am only too happy to hear from you. And now I'm going to end this segment with my regular signature. And this one is especially for Kat. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Hold on to your seats. Democratic strategists have once again figured out a way to interpret depressing Washington news. As always, the fault lies with those mean and nasty Republicans. Yeah, news from Washington has been anything but slow lately. Hungry readers and journalists have been treated to a virtual smorgasbord. But if current events are riveting, the reason is a sad one. Horrific, despicable deeds by trusted employees of the United States government are coming into greater focus every single day. How does one process a multiplicity of overwhelming news stories, especially when reports expose more twists, turns, and cover-ups than an entire television season of 24? Where's Jack Bauer when we need him? Actually, matters are not quite as complex as they appear. There is a common thread connecting each tainted garment. Every story in the unholy trinity of scandals, Benghazi, IRS, and intrusion into AP Fox, interacts on some level with the Obama administration. Therein lies the way out for Democratic spinmeisters. Since Obama is president, and Republicans are the majority party in the House, perhaps American citizens will buy into a familiar interpretation. The only motive to keep those stories alive is a political one. In a vain attempt at damage control, White House senior advisor Dan Pfeiffer threw himself into a series of interviews a couple weeks ago, which eerily resembled Ambassador Susan Rice's fiasco from September of 2012. He said, I think we've seen this playbook from Republicans before. What they want to do when they are lacking a positive agenda is to try to drag Washington into a swamp of partisan fishing expeditions, trumped up hearings, and false allegations. We're not going to let that happen. Now, while Pfeiffer admitted that at least the IRS situation was a problem, he still talked as if Republicans were a bigger problem. He said this was a breach of the public trust, and we have to work together to rebuild that trust. That's going to require Republicans to do this in a legitimate, serious, governmental way and not play politics with it. He said that on NBC's Meet the Press, but he was on all the other news shows that morning too. Yeah, that's it, folks. This is the best the left has to offer right now. Republicans supposedly are seeking to play politics by exploiting a tragedy. If only George Bush hadn't been out of office these past 4.5 years, he could take a lion's share of the blame. Actually, wasn't former IRS Commissioner Douglas Shulman appointed under Bush? True, the stuff about Shulman, the stuff he's accused of, well, it all happened under Obama, but any chance to use the word Bush is always helpful. All right, look. Let's be straight here. Do Republicans hope to pave political inroads for 2014 as a result of current Washington scandals? Of course they do. Spoiler alert. Politicians generally have political motives. That's why we call them politicians. Be that as it may, a very fair question just begs to be asked. Are Democrats really in the best position to offer sanctimonious lectures about not exploiting a crisis? The echo of former Obama Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel still bellows down memory lane. He said, rule one, never allow a crisis to go to waste. They are opportunities to do big things. Now, his lesson was not lost on Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat from California, chair of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Her response to Obama's tornado, well, we call it Obama's tornado because it seemed to bail Obama out of some things. It was actually Oklahoma's tornado, and it inspired a very passionate speech from the Senate floor from Boxer. She said, "This is climate change. We were warned about extreme weather, not just hot weather, but extreme weather. Yeah, it's going to get hot. But you're also going to see snow in the summer in some places. You're going to have terrible storms. You're going to have tornadoes and all the rest. We need to protect our people. That's our number one obligation. And we have to deal with this threat that is upon us. And that is going to get worse and worse through the years." And then Senator Boxer, of course, is not one to pontificate without offering solutions. She went on to mention her own bill, surprise, surprise, co-sponsored with Senator Bernie Sanders, designed to place a tax on carbon. She explained, "Carbon could cost us the planet. The least we could do is put a little charge on it so people move to clean energy." Now, of course, tornadoes have been a feature of nature for as long as we can remember. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Even weather is not immune to politics. Not that Boxer invented this current maneuver of changing the title. Oh, it's been floated many times like a helium balloon on a globally warm day. You see, global warming used to be the predominant phrase when Democrats wanted to find creative new ways to demand taxes or special fees from private sector industry. We still hear about global warming when summers are hot, as summers usually are. But when seasons change, record cold spells are harder to categorize as evidence of a warming planet. Even a magician would have trouble pulling that one off, especially when scientists and meteorologists on both sides debate this issue. Fortunately for the Democratic Party, senators work magic better than politicians. Watch how the hand is quicker than the eye, and presto, global warming becomes, yeah, climate change. Who can argue against such genius? Because there's one undeniable fact about climate. It's always changing. That one you can take to the bank. And so while Republicans talk about threats to our country, Democrats have an entire planet to protect. On balance, Democrats want us to see that their pet crisis is the better one. Watch for their talking points to grow. They will tell us that Republicans have a lot of raw, inappropriate nerve. They'll attempt to downplay concern from conservatives. They'll say, "Just look at the trivial stuff that alarms the GOP. All right, Americans in Libya were refused help from our State Department before they were murdered. And sure, that's sad, but heck, it's not as if Obama and the State Department were totally impotent. After all, they promptly diverted tons of energy into a creative explanation about a video-inspired violence as opposed to an Al-Qaeda attack, which it was, and which they knew it was. Now be careful, they'll say. We must not view this tactic as anything political. Only Republicans are political. The fact that our country was in the midst of an election year when Obama bragged about Al-Qaeda being on the demise is purely coincidental. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. We were talking about the news and how all these different scandals related to the Obama administration, one after another, they get so overwhelming. And what the Democrats are hoping, of course, is that they can just say that the Republicans are being political. And like I said, politicians are always political, but that doesn't mean that the things that concern the Republicans shouldn't concern the rest of us. So I'm talking about some talking points, some that we've already heard, others that I'm predicting. You're going to start hearing stuff like, oh, well, as for the IRS, okay, so they hassled some Tea Party group seeking tax-exempt status. Well, aren't all Tea Party people racist anyway? And what? What? They also told a pro-life nonprofit group that they were not allowed to publicly protest Planned Parenthood? Well, what's wrong with that? It's not like they were telling pro-choice groups that they can't protest pro-life organizations. That would have been truly fascist. As for that scandal with the press, well, maybe it was a teensy bit wrong to go after the AP, but anything Eric Holder does to Fox News is only being done to Fox News, right? Fox News is partisan. People at Fox aren't as fair to Obama as objective networks like MSNBC. Republicans must stop all this phony concern for freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of press. Does our First Amendment give us the freedom to yell fire in a crowded room? Republicans could learn from their Democratic cousins. The only real threat to America, and the entire world for that matter, is climate change. Okay, these are the kinds of arguments to expect. They've already begun to surface in one form or another. They will get worse. They will grow and stretch until all who oppose Obama are drawn with horns and a tail. Conservatives should learn to respond with a few simple talking points of their own. Like, yes, it is wrong to yell fire in a crowded room, unless the room really is on fire. As for climate change, we need a change of climate, all right? The world is awfully big, so is America for now. Let's just settle for a change of climate at the White House. Meanwhile, Obama tried a more subtle approach to blaming Republicans, at least as far as Benghazi goes. Remember, he pulled this one up a few weeks ago. Now, I have to say, President Obama may have a lot of faults, but stupidity is not one of them. He still knows how to play his bass like a fine violin. Well, part of that bass, the White House press corps, seems to have rediscovered the long-lost art of asking real questions. Obama himself remembered a different maneuver called preemptive strike. Now, that might sound like a military strategy for protecting American lives in places like Benghazi, but Obama uses a verbal version instead to deflect discussion about this very same Benghazi. While preparing for a news conference shared with the Prime Minister of Turkey, Obama was aware that even his loyal reporters are now being forced to actually do their jobs. Perhaps they're doing it kicking and screaming, but even the White House press corps cannot ignore three scandalous flavors to choose from: Benghazi, IRS, and AP. Well, I guess it's four if we count Fast and Furious. All right, five if we count the Verizon Wireless records that came out this week. Hard to keep up with them all. Anyway, evidently Obama feels his damage control for two out of three is working. Benghazi, on the other hand, a little trickier, simply will not go away. Thus, his decision to get it off the table before anyone could even ask a question. He said, I'm calling on Congress to work with us to support and fully fund our budget requests to improve our embassies around the world. Now, this was a brilliantly played hand. While not coming out in so many words and placing blame on Republicans for the Benghazi murders, Obama's less than subtle insinuation suggests that had Congress, mostly a Republican Congress, incidentally, had Congress provided more funds, perhaps Ambassador Stevens and three other Americans might still be alive. If pressed later under oath, Obama insists he never held Republicans responsible in so many words. Technically, he will be telling the truth. While telling the truth might be a whole new experience for Barack Obama, he still knows how to use it like a good lie. Here's why we know the insinuation is a lot of bull pucky on rye with mustard. Charlene Lamb, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Programs, was asked during a House Oversight and Government Reform Committee interrogation if the denial of additional security for Benghazi had anything to do with budget cuts. She said, and I quote, "No, sir." And then went on to add, "We had the correct number of assets in Benghazi on the night of 9/11. Unfortunately, real, honest-to-goodness facts have little to do with political talking points. After all, if Democratic strategists were able to blame George Bush for every American problem during the first 4 years of Obama's presidency, they can certainly blame a whole litter of Republicans who happened to be running Congress while the White House and State Department ran the Benghazi consulate. It might just work. True believers will sidestep facts and cling to faith." Well, Republicans certainly have their share of wackos, sometimes dubbed birthers. Democrats have birthers of their own, those who believe Barack Obama was born in a manger. Why blame the Messiah when there are partisan Republicans to kick around instead? And then, of course, there's the plausible deniability defense. I love this one. Plausible deniability is a tried and true maneuver in the history of modern politics. The idea is quite simple. When a president's desire or intentions are more or less informally understood, without anything actually appearing in writing, surrogates can get a job done all the while making very sure they never report officially to the president. That way, when something like an Iran-Contra affair is discovered, Vice Admiral John Poindexter can stay before Congress, as he did in 1987. "I made a deliberate decision not to ask the president so that I could insulate him from the decision and provide some future deniability for the president if it ever leaked out." It worked. Ronald Reagan never crashed and burned, even though his administration did sell arms for hostages. And he ran on saying that he'd never make deals with terrorists. I hope Kat is still listening. Do you hear that, Kat? I just criticized Ronald Reagan, the most popular Republican in modern times. I also criticized Republican birthers a while ago. Did you catch that? All right. So, plausible deniability is what Reagan had, and it continues. Like Halley's Comet, this clever defense returns to our planet from time to time. The latest visit is a welcome one to desperate Obama supporters, finding it next to impossible to defend their president against the suggestion that he himself encouraged the IRS to specifically delay conservative or Tea Party organizations seeking tax-exempt status prior to the 2012 election. Which sounds worse? Obama the liar who knew everything? Or Obama the dense who knew nothing? Obama's surrogates have a hard time choosing the lesser of two evils. Plausible deniability manages to avoid both interpretations.
Your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that he is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
Welcome back to our program. This is Bob Siegel. Plausible deniability. That's how Obama surrogates are trying to defend him when they claim they don't know about any of these scandals like the IRS. The IRS was coincidentally auditing people who might have contributed to Romney's campaign. People like the Tea Party. Jumping Jiminy, I had no idea at all that that was going on. So which is it? Obama, who's lying when he really knew everything, or Obama, who's so clueless he knew nothing? Again, plausible deniability manages to avoid both interpretations. Supposedly, Obama was deliberately shielded. His subordinates did not want him to know. They are so loyal, they will take the fall by enabling him to say with a straight face that he was uninvolved with the scandal. Just recently, political satirist Jon Stewart suggested to Fox News' Bill O'Reilly that Obama's people were undoubtedly retreading this familiar tactic. He said, "Don't you think they're trying to make a case for plausible deniability?" O'Reilly was quick to respond. He said, "Yeah, of course, but the president sets a tone, like you set a tone for this program." I agree with O'Reilly. Yes, the president sets a tone, but this tone was more like an alarm on an atomic submarine. To put plausible deniability under the microscope, one need look no further than the May 16th press conference. Obama was asked a very direct question about the IRS situation by Juliana Goldberg of Bloomberg News. Juliana Goldman, I should say. I said Goldberg, it's Bloomberg News, Juliana Goldman. I'm going to get that right. She said, "Mr. President, I want to ask you about the IRS. Can you assure the American people that nobody in the White House knew about the agency's actions before your counsel's office found out on April 22nd? And when they did find out, do you think that you should have learned about it before you learned about it from the news reports, as you said last Friday? And also, are you opposed to there being a special counsel appointed to lead the Justice Department investigation?" Well, Obama avoided the question while trying to make it look like he had actually answered it. Again, this guy plays with a full deck. He's got a lot going on upstairs because he's assuming everybody else is so naive they won't catch it. He avoids the question, but he's so skilled he makes it look like he's answering the question. Maybe he counted on people being so shocked to hear the White House press corps actually asking a real question that they would forget to analyze his response. First, Obama said, "Let me make sure that I answer your specific question." Then he continued with a non-answer. He said, "I can assure you that I certainly did not know anything about the IG report before the IG report had been leaked through the press. Typically, the IG reports are not supposed to be widely distributed or shared. They tend to be a process that everybody is trying to protect the integrity of. But what I'm absolutely certain of is that the actions that were described in that IG report are unacceptable." Okay, even one of Jeff Foxworthy's fifth graders could have noticed that Goldman never asked when Obama first heard about the IG reports. Her question was much more sweeping, and it was not limited to Obama's personal knowledge. She asked if anybody in the White House found out about the IRS's tactics prior to April 22nd. She also asked why White House staff would not have said something to the president. Of course, nobody was supposed to notice Obama's dodgeball reaction. After all, Obama himself prefaced his statement by telling us that we were about to hear a specific answer. If he called it an answer, it must have been an answer, right? I mean, this is the guy who speaks with charisma. This is the guy that speaks with nuance. When a smooth-talking former attorney turned president carefully avoids a question, something is being covered up, people. Since he was being asked about White House knowledge, it's safe to guess that White House knowledge is exactly what is being hidden. To hide something, a person must know what he is hiding, and to hide something, a person must know why he is hiding it. Wanting to make sure he is never nailed for lying about his honest knowledge, Obama can always claim that he only supplied a timeline about the IG reports. While reviewing this Oscar-caliber performance, thinking people must conclude that Obama's plausible deniability looks a little less plausible. All right, let's change gears. I know that some of you love the politics, some of you hate the politics, some of you listen in more for our theology. So let's switch now to the Bible. Here's a question that I get often. Bob, the resurrection of Jesus is an extraordinary claim. Don't extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence? Okay, now this familiar slogan has been repeated often to me by my atheist friends. Whenever I speak of the historical validity of the resurrection, whenever I point out that if the same amount of eyewitnesses and historians who claim Jesus rose from the dead merely claim that Jesus gave a speech or merely claim that Jesus started a revolution, nobody would doubt it. But I say that and they smile and say, well, extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. Since people don't rise from the dead every day, that's an extraordinary claim. Now, I tend to resist that phrase. To me, we either have evidence or we don't. It's either good evidence or it isn't. Our process for examining historical evidence must be objective. If we're going to begin with the bias that miracles are impossible, then no amount of evidence will ever be enough. Now then, let us leave the field of history for just a moment and venture into science, another discipline where people believe they have dismissed God once and for all. There's a saying in science, nothing is proven unless it is repeatable and observable. Although microevolution, changes within the same species, can be observed, macroevolution, changes from one species to another, are not being observed. Neither would an evolutionist make such a claim, since it would take millions of years in his opinion. Evolution does not merely teach that man came from ape-like creatures. It teaches that all species were once related. Birds, reptiles, mammals, fish, all related. Now, if this is really true, we should find literally billions upon billions upon billions of missing link fossils. Knowing that we don't even come remotely close, evolutionists still point to a handful, very small handful, of alleged fossils, very disputed amongst scientists, even disputed amongst fellow evolutionists, that they cling to these findings as clear, abundant evidence for macroevolution. At this point, I just have to make a simple observation. Claiming that all species were once related is an extraordinary claim. What happened to extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence? Okay, this next question I kind of teased you with at the beginning of the show, so now I get a chance to tease you with it again before we go to our break. Radio can be so much fun. How can I follow Jesus when I've had negative religious experience? We'll discuss that when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Can I follow Jesus when I've had negative religious experience? Very good question. Maybe you had a bad experience with church. Maybe as a kid you were dragged to Sunday school against your will. Maybe he used to throw spit wads as Mrs. Pumpernickel tried desperately to interest you in the missionary journals of the Apostle Paul. You may have grown up listening to long sermons, anxiously looking at your watch to see how much of the game you were missing at home on TV as the pastor made his 17th point. Or perhaps you were not raised as a Christian. Instead, you merely encountered Christians. Yeah, that'll do it. Maybe some obnoxious personality tried to shove the gospel down your throat using all the tact of a lawnmower in a barbershop. Or possibly your rapport with Christianity had nothing to do with evangelism, but you have seen enough of life to observe that people who go to church often behave worse than the non-religious. Okay, hypocrisy is often cited as a reason to reject the claims of Christ, and it is maybe the most understandable reason. In fact, when the philosopher Bertrand Russell was asked why he never became a Christian, one of his chief complaints came from an observation that so few Christians seem to take the teachings of Jesus seriously. A hypocrite is one who acts contrary to his or her words or beliefs, but we must carefully qualify this as Christians because sometimes people don't understand what they believe. Christianity, by definition, teaches that nobody acts consistent with their beliefs, at least not completely consistent. And Christian beliefs, what we mean by Christian beliefs, are what we believe at our core, what we believe in our conscience. Our conscience condemns our selfish natures. If we are honest, we admit that we do not follow our conscience very well. We admit that we need Jesus as Savior. We admit that we need forgiveness. Now, if a Christian claimed to be without sin, if a Christian claimed he didn't need forgiveness and started acting self-righteous, acting like he could earn his way to God, contradicting the message of Christianity, well, then that would be the epitome of hypocrisy. On the other hand, since after receiving God's Holy Spirit, anybody who receives it is more capable of walking in obedience than they were before, if they then continue to deliberately disobey, this too can be called hypocrisy. Now, I don't think anyone, Christian or otherwise, is completely free of this trait. I must certainly confess to such reoccurring inconsistency. At the same time, I do not claim to be perfect because I call myself a Christian. My claim is that of a covenant relationship with God, in which He is at work in my life, slowly but surely changing the inner character. I have many instances of downright rebellion against His rule in my heart. Even after I repent and focus on God as much as I can, all that means that I'm better than I was yesterday, but not as good as I will be tomorrow. What God does with me, He's willing to do with anyone. I'm not superior or singled out in any way. Now, although the born-again person does not claim perfection, we have to also keep in mind that many of the people who call themselves Christians are not really Christians at all. It's easy for people to use this title because of the strong Christian influence upon Western civilization. And this has created a variety of pseudo-Christian traditions, from the sincere, faithful church attendee who does not understand what it means to know Christ personally, to the horrible, bloodthirsty murderers of the Crusades and the Inquisition, who do not seem to share even the slightest resemblance to the simple, loving message of the New Testament. As I mentioned earlier, my own people, the Jews, have been hounded and murdered for centuries in the name of Christianity. And this shameful horror kept me blinded to the real Jesus for quite some time. If hypocrisy is your concern, it may surprise you to learn that you actually have something in common with Jesus because Jesus hated religious hypocrisy and preached against it quite often. These were some of his very first words. They're from his very first sermon. I'm reading from Matthew chapter 7. He says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" This interesting discourse, again, given very early in Jesus' ministry, proved to be very prophetic. Therefore, my friends, hypocrisy in the church, while sad, is not a phenomenon which contradicts the words of Christ, for he not only spoke of hypocrisy, but hypocrisy in his name. He predicted hypocrisy. Try to imagine some mere man, ambitious, anxious to start a following, gathering people together before things even get rolling. He says, "Can I have your attention? Can I have your attention? Thanks for showing up. Great turnout. Just want you to know that many of you who call yourselves my followers will be cast into hell by me personally. Just thought you should know. Not very likely. Such chilling honesty suggests from the onset that there's more to Jesus than meets the eye. He's making it clear that regardless of terminology or sworn allegiance, true Christians have two minimum qualities. First, a personal relationship with God. He said these people who weren't true Christians, God said, I never knew you. Now he's God. Of course, God knows who they are. That word to know in Greek referred to an intimate knowledge, a relationship. And two, an obedience to God that follows this relationship. Now, although elsewhere in Scripture it is made clear that sinless perfection cannot be obtained in this life, Jesus is nevertheless emphasizing that true followers are at least on God's path. And his words here in Matthew let us in on a little secret. There are some people who are not truly on God's road, and somehow they still do mighty religious deeds, even supernatural ones. This is a scary and sobering thought. Still, we conclude that religious hypocrisy is not a genuine reason with which to reject the real Jesus and his true teachings. Now, here's a very interesting question. We've done a lot of shows about science fiction in the last few weeks, so I thought this would be a good one for today. Does the idea of life on other worlds contradict the Bible? It's a good question. Well, the Bible does not address the question of beings on other planets, but it does speak of another dimension of life called heaven. Still, there is absolutely nothing in Scripture to refute the theory of life on other planets. Having said that, there's usually more than meets the eye when this question is asked. Often the dogma of both Christian and skeptic alike comes forth. Christians tend to think that the idea of intelligent life on other worlds contradicts their faith, while atheists act as though life on other planets would contradict the Bible. Both are mistaken. To explore this topic, let's begin now with what we do know from Scripture. First of all, there is intelligent life on another world. If there is intelligent life on another world, I should say, it would not be superior to human life. According to the Bible, nothing is of more value to God than human beings. It is humans who are made in his image. That means spiritual image. Doesn't mean God looks like a man. We may someday discover other humans or life equal to that of a human, but nothing superior. Meanwhile, we already know that a type of intelligent life does exist outside the boundaries of our own world. The Bible tells us much about beings known as angels and demons. Now, we can't get into detail about angels and demons. We did a couple of shows about that over a month ago. You could go to my website. You could download it. But we got to save the detail for a different discussion. And yet, we can marvel how quickly skeptics dismiss the idea of angels and dismiss the idea of demons, yet accuse Christians of being too closed-minded when discussing intelligent life on other worlds. Well, that is exactly what demons and angels are, intelligent life existing at least in other dimensions, if not other planets. You're going, yeah, but Bob, atheists usually mean mortal life on other actual planets when bringing up the subject of aliens. That's true. And let's face facts. And here now I want to challenge my atheist friends. If intelligent life did develop elsewhere, it would be far more of a contradiction to evolution than it would be to the idea of God. According to the theory of evolution, life developed randomly, and there would be a billion to one shot that it could accidentally happen again. But if the universe works according to a purpose, if life is the result of a plan put forth by a creator, then it makes perfect sense that he could have created intelligent life in many places. And say, well, supposing we were visited by aliens who claimed there was no God. All that would mean was that we encountered beings who did not believe in God. As a matter of fact, not all of our astronauts believe in God. So what if they went somewhere and told someone there wasn't a God? See, it works both ways. I should say, too, in Scripture, the term world kept changing. When Jesus told his disciples to share the gospel over the world, to them the world was Europe, Asia, and America. The very notion of crossing the Atlantic Ocean and finding a continent later named the Americas, but originally designated the New World, meeting Native Americans, that would have been about as bizarre in those days as us today discovering humanoid life on some far-off planet and deciding to share the gospel with this new species. Who knows? The world that Jesus returns to someday might be a whole solar system. And you're thinking, well, Bob, does that mean we should accept books like Chariots of the Gods? No, not at all. Those kinds of books attempt to explain away the miracles of the Bible and attribute them to alien beings instead. We can dismiss such nonsense all the while embracing the notion of life on other planets as a concept. The Bible exists primarily to carve the way of salvation and forgiveness of sins. It does not seek to answer every mystery of the universe. Christian and skeptic alike should maintain an open mind regarding such speculations. And I will open my mind with you again next week. You're always welcome. Your questions are welcome too.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.